and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello there.
Hey, the fast food wars are amping up. We'll be talking about that a little bit later in Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. It is one of those days where it's a here, hold my beer. If you think you've seen something, wait till you see the next story coming out in Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, Tim.
All right.
Oh, it is nuts. And I'll tell you what, making me afraid to go out anywhere again. I think I'm starting to miss the lockdown, to be honest with you. People are lunatics. We've got a great guest joining us here this afternoon. This is a case I've been interested in talking about on True Crime Tuesday since we started this, geez, almost a decade ago. Mm-hmm. The Wonderland Murders and Secret History of Hollywood is a new podcast series by Michael Connelly, available on Audible on July 1st. It is coming out. Make sure you guys go check this out. This is going to be an amazing depiction of the Wonderland stories, digging into a part of history many of us don't even know about. Michael Connelly, our guest today, is a best-selling author of over 36 novels and one work of nonfiction, with over 80 million copies of his books sold worldwide in 40 foreign languages and over 1 million audiobooks sold just in 2020 alone. He is one of the most successful writers working today. The new program, as I said, kicks off on July 1st. The Wonderland Murders and Secret History of Hollywood. We'll have a link up for that on today's program guide, so make sure you check that out. Welcome to the show, Michael. Thank you for being here with us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is such an interesting story and so much to unpack. You guys have released this. It's going to be an 8-episode Audible podcast series. I've got a question. I would think this story and just what you really get into could probably fill 24 episodes and you'd still have things left over. Was it hard to pare down everything involved in this case into 8 segments like this?
It was hard to just kind of wrap your arms around it because it does go in so many directions. And, you know, I'd do an interview and then I'd find out, you know, a tangentially linked other crime, another murder or so forth. Someone who had a part in this case ends up getting, you know, I talk about it in the podcast, getting killed in a market in Tel Aviv. You know, it's just weird the tendrils of this case, how far and wide they go. And that became a difficult thing. How much time do you spend on this key player in the case in Los Angeles ending up getting murdered over here or because of this and that? And so, you know, it took a long time to kind of figure out what we wanted to do. I've always believed that, you know, less is more. But at the same time, we're giving about almost eight hours of storytelling here. So I think it's actually more than ever has been reported about this case.
Well, for listeners, the podcast follows the 9 lives of a man best known as Liberace's lover and confidant. He was played by Matt Damon in the movie Behind the Candelabra, revealing himself here to be kind of the Zelig of awful. And the tour guide into Hollywood's dark underbelly, I like your tagline on it. He's either the ultimate con man or the ultimate witness to the secret history of Hollywood. This story gets thrown back to 1981. And I'm curious, out of all the strange cases and bizarre stories that exist out there, what drew you to want to dig deeper into the Wonderland murders explore this case and story?
Well, two things. One, I had a long time fascination in it. I'm a former journalist. I came to Los Angeles in 1987 to cover crime for the LA Times. And that was 6 years after the murders. But when I arrived, local justice system was gearing up for the first murder trials of the alleged mastermind behind these murders. And I probably should say for the record, and if people don't know about this case, it's about 4 people that were very savagely, brutally beaten to death in a house in Laurel Canyon on Wonderland Avenue in L.A. in 1981, actually 40 years ago, Thursday, July 1st. And so I had a fascination with the crime as a journalist, as someone who came to Los Angeles, and, you know, it was another one of these kind of iconic Los Angeles cases. So there's that. I also lived in Laurel Canyon for a number of years and lived just a couple blocks away from the house where this happened. So there's also that. But then jump forward almost 40 years, and I get a, I have a cadre of current and former homicide detectives with the LAPD to help me with my books. I'm a former journalist. I want my novels, even though they're fiction, to be as accurate to the world of police work as I can get them. And I use, a group of people that are willing to help me. And it so happens that one of those detectives, now retired, but was a longtime homicide investigator for the LAPD, had a key part in this case. And one day, about a year ago, he was talking about how Scott Thorson, the witness that he brought into the case, a key witness in the case, had reached out to him and had always stayed in touch with him. And what a colorful, weird, and somewhat tragic character he was. And this detective just said, would you ever want to talk to him? It might be an interesting story. This is a detective who's also involved in the prior podcasts I've done. So a little bit of longtime interest, and then something current happened where I was given the opportunity to meet, as you call him, the Zelig of Awful, which is a very apt title for him.
When you look at on the whole, all right, 40 years have passed. Is it one of those situations of, well, what more could there be to be told about these cases, about these stories? Is that kind of what drives you into kicking over a few more stones to see if there are still gems out there that relate back to this part of history?
Yeah, there is. You can call it egotistical or whatever, but because of my books, I have an access to the LAPD. I know a lot of people within the LAPD. A lot of people trust me to tell a story accurately. And so I went into it thinking, well, I might have an entree into this story that other people didn't have. I also knew that 40 years later, most of the people, if they're still alive, are retired. And I've always found that people that are not working within a bureaucracy are more open to talking about it after they're out of it. And that's exactly what happened. I got pretty amazing access. I've got parts of this story that have never been told over 40 years, if you can believe it or not, because it's a story that's had books written about it, documentaries, a movie starring Val Kilmer. Blogs are out there, prior podcasts. But I'm very confident that I'm telling a story that's fuller and that has not been told in this complete way before. And you said kicking over stones and finding new gems. Yeah, we have a lot of those, I think, in this podcast.
That's fantastic. I've got to guess, going back, revisiting with these officers that are now retired and a little bit, as you said, not under that bureaucracy, and they're able to be a little more forthcoming. Do you find that there is some pushback, a little bit of resistance, though, so that it doesn't appear as though they missed something or were inept in any way in their job, or are they very open about things that they feel were overlooked or under-examined in these cases?
I think they've been very open, and it's not like I've got any gotcha moments, but, a big thing is that Thorson was in the house where Eddie Nash ordered his henchmen to go out and seek revenge on these people. He was there. He was like a witness to this, and that never was known to police for 7 years. And, his name came up on the list, but this guy was a drug dealer. People were in and out of his house all the time. And so Scott Thorson was literally a name that was one of hundreds. And so they did, talk to him, and he basically hung up on them, and it was like, well, we have 200 more names to go over, so we keep... water seeks its own level. They were looking for people that would talk to him. So when this guy hung up on them, they just moved on. And, they don't regret that. They knew they had a lot of work to do, and there was nothing that stood out to them that made them say, we got to find this Scott Thorson and talk to him and make him talk to us. And so, there was a 7-year gap when all along this guy had some key information. And, the way it came about was actually quite lucky, but they're acknowledging of that. As the lead detective on the case, Tom Lang, said to me just the other day when I was talking to him, you know, murder is messy. It's not like your books. It's not like fiction where villains are always caught and loose ends are tied up. In real life, murder is messy, and, you know, things get missed. And, you know, so they're pretty open about that. You know, they were relentless in their pursuit of this, and I think that's what they can hold on to and be proud of, that they never gave up.
Well, let me ask you this then. You know, suddenly you're hearing from this guy 40 years after the fact. How much concern is there in the accounts that he's about to share with you, A, for accuracy? I mean, let's face it, sometimes it's hard for us to remember what happened 3 weeks ago, clearly, let alone 40 years ago. Also, you've got a character who is very quirky, right? How hard is it to separate fact from fiction in the tales that are being spun for you?
Well, that's the task. And, you know, from the very first episode, I call him an unreliable narrator. I take a phrase from my fiction, a form of telling a story where you're not sure if the person's telling the truth. And that is Scott Thorson. And I have detectives who say he tells the truth, and I have detectives who say every word that comes out of his mouth is a lie. That, to me, is a great construct. So the job of my job and the job of the podcast is to take what he's saying and check it against facts, check it against other people's memories. And you're right, 40 years ago, you know, it's tough to remember what was going on 40 years ago. These were very hyper intensive moments in this crime and so forth, so that there's a better chance of impact of memory. But at the same time, that's my job, to figure out whether this guy is telling the truth. And as you go through the podcast, you see where I can either disprove or prove something from an outside form of evidence or documentation and so forth. I mean, this goes back to what I said earlier about my access. I've gotten access to the case files, the documentation that no one's ever had. And so it's full of stuff that no one has ever known. And it debunks stuff that is pretty widely accepted about the case. It confirms other things. And, you know, this is the official documentation of it. So it's good to have this when
right.
Scott Thorson starts saying something. But, I, you know, the bottom line with me and Scott Thorson is that they missed him for 7 years. But then when they got him, I have the summaries of his very first interviews in jail, very first interviews, and then I have summaries of repeated interviews. His story does not change, and all homicide detectives, long before I did this podcast, they've always told me that when you have a snitch, someone who is out for themselves first, willing to trade information for, like, help on a case and so forth, which was Thorson's situation, you make them tell the story over and over and over again, and then you start seeing cracks in it if it's lies, if it's based on lies. And, you know, I've done that myself. I started this podcast, the research or the reporting of it, over a year ago, and I've had so many conversations with Scott Thorson, and I've gone back over and over again the case. And then, and this was before I was able to get all this documentation, and so then lo and behold, months into this, I'm able to procure the case files and stuff, and there are these summaries, and the story has not changed. He has said the same story every time. And so I think there's a level of confirmation or credence, whatever you want to call it, in that. Again, he could have started with a lie, and always stuck with his lie, but a lot of what he says matches to the facts and the evidence. So it's a gray area. I'm not going to say that he's 100% honest. I don't believe that for a second. But I think it's very well documented that he has a place in this case, and then it becomes, just like the detectives way back in the day, it becomes my job to try to get through all the fuzz around it and get to the bone of the truth.
Well, let me, if you don't mind, let me read the synopsis here for the series, so people know a little bit more about this, and maybe we can unpack some of this information. The synopsis, though it happened in 1981, the aftermath of the Wonderland murders spans decades with characters, details, subplots, and investigative twists that prove the truth is stranger than fiction adage, including Hollywood's underworld's most violent drug kingpin, three murder trials with zero convictions, a bribed juror, and accusations of a corrupt federal agent. The birth of the crack cocaine epidemic, the investigators behind are being investigated themselves, the Black Gorilla family, the biggest porn actor of his generation, John Holmes, not to mention wild claims about the drug use of many major celebrities, a Boston Mafia Don, and finally the story of a quick buck televangelist who was supposed to be in witness protection when he ended up on the floor of a Florida motel, shot in the face and left for dead. That's a synopsis, The Wonderland Murders and Secret History of Hollywood, a podcast series by Michael Connelly. Walk us through and I understand you go so deep into these stories and cases throughout the 8-episode arc, but if you could, let's look at an overview of the Wonderland murder case. Take us back to that time and give us a little bit of the background of what was going on.
Well, I think one reason why this case has had a resonance across four decades and is kind of like in the dark pantheon of iconic LA crime is this location. Wonderland Avenue is in Laurel Canyon, which is in, a small part of the larger Hollywood Hills. And it's a very wooded, bucolic idyll, if you will. And so when you have four people savagely beaten to death in a house in this place, that alone stands out. But also what underlines it is this is kind of like the capper on the end of an era in Laurel Canyon. In the 70s, the culture and the music all kind of had its seed. It all emerged out of Laurel Canyon. This is where Crosby, Stills, and Nash lived, where Joni Mitchell lived, where Linda Ronstadt lived, where a lot of the Eagles lived, James Taylor. The whole 70s, I keep calling it the peaceful, easy feeling, to quote an Eagles song.
Right.
That whole kind of country rock culture and music that kind of took over the business. It was really when the music business at that time was all centered in New York. It shifted to L.A. because this is where the music was being made that the baby boomers were listening to. So there's this mythos about Laurel Canyon, an aura about it. And then it went away because they became millionaires. The music industry became, when the baby boomers started listening to music, it became a billion-dollar business. And rustic Laurel Canyon changed and people went away. And a lot of it had to do with drugs. It was flower power in simple times when it was marijuana and hallucinogenics. But when cocaine entered the picture, it changed things. So these murders, which are drug-related, which some of the victims were drug dealers, and they were drug dealers to some of the music makers in Laurel Canyon. This was kind of like the tombstone at the end of that era, and the whole center of music and so forth shifted back to New York. So it was like kind of a brief moment, and these murders kind of set an end point or a cap on that period. And so I think that's also one reason why they stand out. And then, I'm mostly known, obviously, as a novelist and I deal in this world where my books start with chaos, a murder, and then a fearless and fierce detective sees the case through and makes an arrest, and order is restored, and loose ends are tied up. And that's the world of fiction. That didn't happen in this case. No one was ever convicted of murder. Yes, the mastermind, this guy named Eddie Nash, the powerful drug dealer, ultimately, 20 years later, pled guilty to conspiracy to commit murder, but he had also beaten two trials where he was charged with murder. And so you could say there's a conclusion there, but it was very unsatisfactory, I think. And it was antithetical to the world where you think you start with chaos, four people beaten to death, blood all over the walls, and people beaten to point of not being recognized. That utter chaos. I mean, the podcast starts with the first officer who's never told his story talking about going into that house and discovering all this. From that moment of chaos, we don't have order restored 40 years later, and that's one reason why I think this case sticks with people and people remember it and people wonder about it. And storytellers like me keep coming back to it.
Well, and obviously, as I mentioned in the kind of summation of the entire series, there's so many different twists and turns and angles on this. How does this house end up basically a bloodbath? Why there? Why are these people in those crosshairs at that time in history? Is it drug? Is it power? Is it a mixture of many different things, misunderstandings? What can you talk to us about on that?
I don't know if there's any misunderstandings here. The people in that house, the men, the people that were murdered were two men and two women, and the women were largely innocent victims, although one of them had a drug case, so she was probably selling drugs for the men. But the men, the two men were part of what they called the Wonderland Gang, and they were drug dealers, and they were also thieves. They were all addicted. They had pretty big heroin habits. And so they were either selling or using their drugs, and they were constantly doing robberies to sustain this lifestyle. And through the porn star John Holmes, who was also an addict and one of their customers and a frequenter of that house on Wonderland Avenue, like I think most people that are caught in this world of addiction, they didn't just buy from one person. This guy, John Holmes, the porn star, knew of another house on the other side of the canyon where a powerful and well-connected guy who was dealing with Colombian cartels and so forth to move large quantities of cocaine into Los Angeles and heroin, named Eddie Nash. Holmes said, that guy has drugs, he has cash, you guys should rob him. And that started this whole thing off. The Wonderland Gang robbed Eddie Nash, took from him cash, drugs, guns, and dignity. They humiliated him, put him on his knees, put a gun in his mouth. And this is a guy who had a healthy ego as a drug kingpin. And so after that robbery was over, he wanted revenge. And it didn't take him long to figure out that John Holmes was the guy who set this up. So he brought John Holmes in, had his henchmen grab John Holmes, bring him in. They beat him up very badly till he admitted his complicity in the robbery. And then they made him lead the henchmen back to that house in Wonderland in the middle of the night to exact revenge. Holmes was able to get them in because Holmes was known to the people living in that house. So he got the killers in, and it's speculated that it was as many as four other men went in there and methodically beat five people up. One miraculously survived. The woman survived, but survived with zero memory of what had happened because she had been beaten with like everyone in there beaten with steel pipes while she had been asleep. So that's the basis of this. And, and the story gets bizarre and sad and very telling of its time. The people, including the woman who is still alive and apparently moaning, they were in there for almost something like 16 hours before anyone called the police. And during that 16 hours, lots of people that bought drugs from them came in there, looked around for drugs, found drugs, some drugs and then left and never even called the police. So it's kind of emblematic about that life and that time and the lack of basic human compassion that people would not even call the police.
That the drug was that powerful to people that was the driving factor for them. And most likely, instead of seeing a horrific crime scene, they just saw a moment of opportunity or a moment of desperation of, now where am I going to get my drugs? And that was probably the deepest thought that was put in on any of that.
Exactly. And, you know, so that's a real starting point of depravity. And, you know, the cops come into this, the detectives, and have to try to sort this out. And as many of the people I interviewed for this say, many of the prosecutors and the investigators and even a judge say that when a crime is committed in hell, you're not going to find angels as witnesses. So
right.
The detectives had to, you know, flip people that were part of this world to start piecing together information. They attempted to talk to Scott Thorson. He was one of literally hundreds of names that had come up, and they didn't connect with him. He was not looking to be helpful to the police at that point. And the case went on. They did charge Holmes with murder. He went to trial. He was found not guilty. As the podcast kind of outlines, that was part of a strategy to try to get Holmes to talk. They knew Holmes knew all the details, who was there. He knew everything, and they needed to get him to talk. And their various efforts, taking him to trial for murder, putting him before a grand jury and jailing him when he refused to talk. He never spoke. He never talked. And some people say it was because he was definitely afraid of Eddie Nash. But I've come to realize what some of the other investigators said. He just did not want to go down in history as a snitch. Because even when he was on his deathbed, dying of AIDS 6 years later, and the police came to him one more time to say, do you want to tell us what happened? You know, there's no threat against your life. You're down to days, maybe weeks. Now's the time to tell us what happened. And he still wouldn't tell them what happened. So that's a...
Do you believe that was that over fear of maybe not what would happen to him, but those that he left behind? Was he still in a protective mode that way?
It could have been. But he had pretty much lost everybody in his life by then. Was kind of on his own in life, so it's hard to believe that. But you know, it's unclear as to whether like anyone got an alternate message to him, like, "Hey, just go out if you talk to anyone, even on the deathbed confession, people that you at least used to know and love would pay." That's a possibility. It's you know, like in most things in this case, it's not completely clear. But he did go to his grave of all the secrets, and that left, that made Scott Thorson's stock certainly rise when he needed help. He got arrested for a robbery and so forth and was facing prison time. It was only then that he decided that he would cooperate with authorities.
And once Scott Thorson enters the picture, again, how big does this blow up for the prosecutors and the police department? Is there enough meat on the bone, differences and things that they didn't know to make this a vibrant investigation again?
Yeah, I think it did breathe new life. In the early 80s, after the crime, there had been a prosecutor assigned to everything to do with Eddie Nash, drug cases, murder cases, everything. And he left to become a judge. And so a new prosecutor came in and was reviewing things just at the time that Thorson came forward. And, you know, I've got these internal memoranda, I don't know what the plural is, but where this new prosecutor is, you can kind of see his thought processes on the paper, where he's determining that with Thorson and the evidence we've had all along, I think we can make a case here. So they do go forward. And he was ultimately right. They charged Thorson and a bodyguard named Greg Dials with the murders, and they were acquitted. But it was later revealed that Nash had bribed the juror, and that juror held out. So it was 11-1 for conviction. That juror would not change her vote, and the judge considered called a mistrial. I misspoke there. He wasn't acquitted. The case ended in a mistrial. But you know, if he had not bribed that juror, it's very likely this prosecutor would have won the case. And then they retried, and that one was more of an acquittal, but they also didn't have Scott Thorson in that second trial.
Now, as you said, I mean, you know, sometimes life is stranger than fiction. And looking at just how deep and wide this goes and how many players are involved, you know, bribery, graft, deception, lies, all of this piling on. I mean, it sounds like something straight out of a Hollywood movie, not out of reality, right? There's obviously going to be no clean ties to any of this, but it sounds made up. Is there any point in this when you're looking at this case and you're thinking, boy, I couldn't even write something this convoluted and crazy of a plot line?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the opposite. It could only be true because it's too bizarre. You know, I've been writing fiction for 25 years, and more than once, my editor, I've actually based stuff on true things that have happened, and my editor's come back and said, that's not believable. And I would say, well, it actually happened. And she goes, well, that doesn't matter. This is fiction. Everything has to be believable.
And, there has to be logic, you know, in fiction, right?
Yeah, and in real life, it doesn't have to be believable because it isn't. You know, there's so many weird things about this case and so many strange coincidences. Just there's so many things, so many twists and turns that would not be allowed in fiction. And, you know, that's one reason why I enjoy doing it, because it's a total break from the other stuff I do, because I have to construct something that's very believable and all the parts fit. And, you know, it's as smooth as glass, but real life is not like that. Like Tom Lang, the lead investigator, says over and over to me, murder is messy.
Now, as you take a deep look into this case, and obviously you've kicked over a lot of new stones that definitely had something intriguing to say on this. Where does that put this case today? Does it put it in a place where law enforcement have enough to go on to maybe get acquittals, or has that window of opportunity passed? Or not acquittals, but convictions?
It may have passed because, you know, we have so much more technology now. But we were kind of naive, I guess, back in the day, so that when that case I just talked about, the first murder case against Nash and Dials, ends in a mistrial, and then they try again, and he's acquitted, they're acquitted. At that point, the powers that be, I guess, in the local justice system thought, that's it. And so they didn't even keep evidence. There were bloody shirts and things like that that now would be a gold mine. You could probably do DNA that might connect that blood that was on the bodyguard's clothing to one of the victims. But back then, they didn't have the science that would do that. And then when they got an acquittal, they just threw it all out. So you know, a federal task force stumbled onto Nash's culpability in this on a wiretap on a completely unrelated case. Someone said something that made the feds go, wow, this guy got away with murder. Maybe we should do something about it. And so they began an investigation in the late 90s, almost 20 years after the murder. And they were hampered by the LAPD not having any of the evidence anymore. None of the physical evidence was there anymore. And, that hurt their chances of getting a successful case and a successful prosecution. They ultimately did, you know, bring the hammer down on Nash, and he was forced into a corner where, rather than risk going to trial and spending the rest of his life in prison, he pled guilty to lesser charges, conspiracy to commit murder, and spent a couple years in prison. That is unsatisfactory justice for the murder of four people, but it did, you know, did provide somewhat of a conclusion to this. But that, you know, that was 20 years ago, and that was two guys charged with murder. And every investigator who's looked at this case that I've talked to said there were more people in that house killing people, and they've never been named. And so you're sorry for this long answer. Getting back to your original question is, where does that leave things now? There's people out there who got away with murder. There's, you know, I've talked to enough people that I think some of these investigators have an idea who those people could be just based on who Nash's associates were back then. But whether the justice system has an appetite to go after them with missing evidence and all that, it seems like a very long shot type of thing to me.
Was it a surprise to you that they had destroyed and gotten rid of all that evidence? Or is that, you know, normal protocol for cases like this when they've tried them twice and have gotten nowhere with it?
I can kind of understand it, but I'm like the naive outsider. I was doing an interview with two guys that were on the federal task force that looked at the case almost 20 years later. And when they told me this, I didn't know it going into this interview. And when they said, like I said, I brought it up, DNA. You know, everyone views DNA as a great, you know, panacea on crime. You know, DNA connections are like the hammer. So I said, was there any, I knew from the documentation and so forth that I had recovered that there were bloody clothes taken from the bodyguard. And so I said, did you guys think about doing DNA? And their answer was like, DNA on what? The LAPD threw it all out once they lost that case. And so I'm sitting here thinking like, oh my gosh, you're kidding me. But then when you think about it, why would they keep that case? They could not try those people again, you know, no double jeopardy. But, you know, if you've been thinking in a broader way, you would have realized oftentimes the federal government comes in with different statutes to rectify what they view as a miscarriage of justice. You know, there's many, many examples of the feds coming in. You know, the biggest one I think of in Los Angeles was when the four officers who beat Rodney King were found not guilty. The feds came in and made a federal case out of it, and they were found guilty. So there was some kind of short-sightedness there in getting rid of this stuff, thinking that was the end of it.
Was there ever any consideration for family members of the victims to go for a civil trial where there may not have been enough evidence, like in the OJ trial, to win the criminal case? They were able to prove the civil case and at least hamper or put a severe financial dent into the people responsible for these murders.
That's a good question. I don't know. None of that ever happened. Whether that was considered and they looked into it, I don't know that answer. But I think it's a good point. I think the issue would have been, I think one of the things that kind of plagued this case, there were no angels involved here. The one person I think they could have made a case was, there was a woman who is completely uninvolved with this group, but was visiting a friend and was sleeping on the couch in that house. She was from upstate California. And so she really had nothing to do with this and you know, had her life taken away from her. And it would seem like her family would have a civil case, but none, as far as I know, was ever filed.
All right. Yeah, I was curious about that angle of it. And, you know, now, do you know that in a civil case, are, you know, if they are going to do this, do they get depositions that could open up new avenues towards a criminal case in the future?
It could. You know, there's all kinds of things that, you know, can still happen and keep something going and keep something alive. But, you know, at this point, I don't think that's a possibility. But, you know, right. why they didn't do it back then, I do not know.
Well, Thorsen came forward, right, to try to better his own position at a time when he was facing jail. Why come forward now, 40 years later, to dig deep into this again? Is it for relevance, to not be forgotten, or guilt? Why did Thorsen feel he wanted to help reexamine this case and turn over, maybe help turn over new leads?
I think you get into the heart of celebrity in this. From an early age, he was on stage with Liberace, and he had that kind of attention and that kind of adulation. And I think he's always searched for it ever since. Now, he didn't come to me and say, let's do a podcast, let's do this story. A detective who was a close friend of mine and helped me with my books was the guy who brought him into the Wonderland case, you know, 30 years ago. And Thorsen has been in and out of prison, mostly for drug situations. And he's always stayed in touch with, this is a detective named Rick Jackson. Over the years, he's always stayed in touch with Rick Jackson. For reasons I'm not really even sure, maybe because he just believes Rick gave him a fair shake. I don't know. And so when Rick just told me in casual conversation that he'd heard from Thorsen after several years, 6 or 7 years since he heard from him, and he told me a little bit about the case back then and the things he did in terms of trying to verify Thorson's story as far as guarding Thorsen during the trials because they thought Eddie Nash would try to kill him. All that stuff was really interesting to me, so I said to Rick, can you set up a call between me and him? Because there might be something here. And so I asked Thorsen if he would do this. And he said yes. But I also don't want to say like he was trying to set the record straight or tell the world the true story. I think there's motives to it. He's very aware of Hollywood from his Liberace days, from the book he wrote, being turned into a movie that won a ton of Emmys, in which he was portrayed by none other than Matt Damon. That there's a, what would you call it, almost an intoxication with that kind of thing. And so when I've had conversations with him over this year, he more than once has said, do you think Matt Damon would want to do this, do the sequel, that kind of thing. So I think he's very aware of fame, probably misses it, or probably feels that this is a way of sustaining it. I should take that back. I don't think he misses it because I don't know if he ever lost it, but he went from being famous to infamous. And there's a subtle line between those, but maybe he doesn't bother caring about that line as long as any attention is attention.
Right. That's what I was wondering. I mean, when you see that, then the credibility factor automatically gets called into effect, right? But you're finding enough information and truth behind the parts of his story and the fact that his story has never really wavered. And those leads have opened up new dynamics, which you're able to explore in the new 8-part series, The Wonderland Murders and Secret History of Hollywood, which will be available, folks, July 1st through Audible. What were some of the most surprising elements? And I know we don't want to give away everything because you've put a lot of work into these 8 hours of programs, but can you give us a taste of some of the aha moments for you in reexamining a case this old?
Well, first, the thing you just said about the credibility, that is exactly right. You know, I mean, this from the very first episode, I call Scott's credibility into question and say, this is my task, this is our task on the podcast to confirm or deny. And you know, so that's what's going on here. Ultimately, in this entire 8 episodes, the listener is going to have to decide, do I believe him or not? You know, I have my own belief in that, and I think I've confirmed a lot of what he said. But ultimately, I think that's one of the cool things about the podcast. You decide. Listen to all this. Figure out who's telling the truth and who isn't. The thing that I you know, when you start doing this, you know, I didn't start thinking like it will be 8 episodes. I didn't know whether it'd be 6 or 10 or 12 or whatever. I just kind of followed the story and went down the rabbit hole and followed it where it went. And I think one of the most surprising destinations of it was the crack epidemic. And, you know, this is well after the murders, but by sticking with Thorson and following his story, he and Nash are on the ground floor of the crack epidemic. They're in part responsible for the scourge of crack in Los Angeles, if not in a wider scope. And that's obviously not something to be proud of, but I don't even know if Scott gets that. You know, he almost feels proud about it. He almost wants, he's unabashed in talking about the ingenuity involved in setting up almost like franchises of crack dealers. And that to me is very interesting because it gives it, I think, a greater dimension, because that devastated cities. You know, the murder rates skyrocketed because of crack wars and people committing crimes to serve their crack addictions and things like that. So there's a big ripple effect from that, and you can go backwards and till the ripples are getting smaller and smaller, and there at the center of them is Eddie Nash and his lieutenant, Scott Thorson. And is it 100% documented in the podcast? No, but it's close. It's close to it. You know, there's enough outside documentation and stories that connect with what Thorson is telling me. And it's not like he's talking about a famous case, a famous murder case like the Wonderland case, and where details are out there. He's revealing details about those days and about big players in the crack epidemic, about the so-called Black Gorilla family, which was a prison gang that was really deeply involved in the crack distribution and so forth. And names and so forth that I've been able to confirm as people that were players in this, it all kind of fits together in a fabric. And like the fabric is not so tightly woven that you can't see through it. You can see through it a little bit, but it's there. And again, listeners can decide about that. But I think that's a significant part of the podcast. I mean, I think it's you know, credible reporting on something that hasn't been reported on before. And then there, you know, there's just smaller things that are very difficult to confirm. Thorson's, it's not even his name now. His name now is Jess Marlowe. His legal name is Jess Marlowe. He's been in prison under that name. The government views him as Jess Marlowe, and he says that's because he was in witness protection, that when he agreed to testify against Eddie Nash, he was put into witness protection. So how do you confirm that? You know, you can't call up, you know, the U.S. Marshal's office and say, is this guy in witness protection? You know, if he's being a con man, he's very clever in telling stories that you can't confirm. And so in the podcast, we go to great lengths to try to confirm or deny that he was in witness protection.
Right. So a lot of little weird twists like that to, again, help bolster your story or show the faulty nature of an addict and a drug supplier, a guy that had his finger on the pulse of that society. And what is he willing to do to, as you said, kind of keep or maintain a level of celebrity and notoriety? And B, what does it really mean then to get to the truth? Does he seem to really, as you said, he's kind of out of touch with the fact of grasping how devastating his actions have been. Is he aware of the overall arch of this and how dark it really is? Or does he seem kind of oblivious, like he's just so steeped in it that this is his life and he doesn't see the true fallout for all?
I think it's the latter. I think he's close to oblivious. Every now and then, I mean, he's known a lot of people that have not survived, people that weren't even necessarily his enemies, but drug dealers that got murdered and, you know, that he supplied and things like that. And So every now and then he's contrite about some of the damage that is done, but it's damage close to him, not the bigger picture. I think he's kind of oblivious.
So it's like the I'm not sorry I did what I did. I'm sorry I got caught. So he's more worried of that kind of concept of the overall scope doesn't bother him, but the things that directly impact him are the things that irritate him or upset him.
Yeah, and he has the I don't know, I was going to say the gene, but whatever. He has a personality effect that nothing was my fault. You know, like I didn't know that was going to happen. You know, when I made, you know, 32 pounds of crack, I did not know it would end up killing people, that kind of thing. You know, that's not a direct quote. I'm just saying
right.
This is his view, or this is how he can, you know, stay within himself, live with himself, I guess you would say.
Can I ask you, as an author who's, you know, written fantastic books and certainly has had quite a bit of attention on him for so long, and you base some of your books and stories on real cases, is it harder when you are digging this deep into a specific set of stories? Does it affect you differently than it does when you research for one of your novels?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I was a journalist for 14 years, so it's not like I lost those skills.
Right.
Or the ethics of journalism. And so, you know, I am staying within the bounds of what I can accurately say and truthfully say in this podcast. And with at the same time throwing out the questions to the viewer, the listener, you decide if this is the truth. I think this, I think that. But, you know, at the same time, when I write fiction, no one gets hurt. And no one's going to get hurt from this podcast, but people did get hurt in the stories that I'm telling. And that does, you know, weigh on you. I think there's a value beyond entertainment to this podcast. I mean, I think it's documentary, and it says a lot about us and where we were. And, you know, if you can deliver a character, no matter how peculiar that character is, like Scott Thorson, and then you balance it by spending time with the character of detectives that have to delve into this human abyss, into these dark waters, and then go home and open the door and say, "Honey, I'm home." You're telling viewers stories about people that they can adhere to and be inspired by, and then you're also delivering character that they wouldn't want to touch with a 10-foot pole. And, you know, I personally think there's a value in that. I think there's a value in telling the story 40 years after it happened.
Do you feel, you know, like you said, nobody gets hurt when you write a novel. You write a book that goes this deep in, kind of an expose or a podcast that's going to go in further than anybody has gone before. Do you ever worry about repercussions from the powers that have been protected all these years, being upset that you're kicking over stones they'd rather left unturned?
I haven't really felt that way. Also, it is 40 years later, so a lot of these people are not around anymore, especially the powers, as you say. But, you know, I'm not trying to make myself out as some, you know, white knight or something. There's nothing brave about what I'm doing. I'm just trying to put my arms around a very complex story. And if I can do that, I've done my job. But I don't think there's a reason not to tell this story, because it might be upsetting to some people who have to live with their own choices and decisions from back then or in the years after.
You know, if I could ask kind of a side question on this, talking to the officers and detectives who were feet on the ground at that time and involved in this case, how did that case, the brutality of it, impact them for the long haul?
What's interesting, if you believe what they've been telling me, not at all. because most of them, like from the uniform patrol cop who was the first guy in there, he never even tracked the case. That's why he never gave any interviews. He wasn't even asked to testify in trials. He knew very little about the case 40 years later. You know, I was telling him stuff. And, you know, I did ask that question, like, well, what, you know, you went into this thing, you had no idea. It's interesting, back then, like, up in these hills, these wooded hills, his radio didn't work. You know, so he was walking into this place where people, bloody pulps all over the place, blood on the wall. And that must have been pretty scary, and there was, like, no backup. It was him and his partner, but it wasn't like they could call on the radio, get up here right away. The radios didn't work back then. They weren't as, you know, developed as they are now. And he said all these years later, he doesn't really even think about it. You know, it was just one night in his long career. And then Tom Lang, who was the lead detective, was in that, you know, they worked on that crime scene for over 24 hours. They didn't remove the bodies for hours and hours, and he was in there. And I said, does that, you know, come up in your dreams, and does it affect you? And he also says no, that especially in the homicide work where you see this, you don't see it to this extreme, but you see right. people who have had their lives taken away from them in brutal ways. He said, if you dwell on that, you're going to have problems. You have to be able to divorce yourself from that and, you know, have compassion, but at the same time, not let it invade your mind and your memory and your life. And he seems to have been able to do that.
Remarkable. The series will be released on July 1st, folks. Two episodes of the podcast on July 1st, then followed by a new episode added each week. The Wonderland Murders and the Secret History of Hollywood. Michael Connelly, thank you so much for joining us today and giving some insights and an overview of this case.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the interest.
It's been a pleasure. All right, folks, make sure you get the series. I've got a link for it in today's program guide. Listen to this series. Fascinating stuff. And now it's time to kick open those case files. We've got dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christbearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, before we get kicked off into dumb crime, stupid criminals, Tim, I do want to make a quick mention. We've got an interesting thing happening live this Thursday night.
All right.
It's true crime. It's paranormal. It's two delicious flavors in one amazing podcast. Jeff Belanger joining me live Thursday night. Darkness Radio presents The Devil Made Me Do It. We're going to talk about the Conjuring 3 movie, the real story behind this case. Jeff Belanger is our guest, so we'll be dipping into true crime and to the paranormal live on Thursday. If you have questions, make sure you watch on our YouTube channel, social media. We put it up on Twitter. We put it up on our Facebook. We put it up on our YouTube channel. Go to the YouTube channel right now. Just go look for Darkness Radio YouTube channel, two separate words, Darkness Radio, and then click the little bell so you always get alerted to when new programs and product is published. So that way you never miss out on any of the cool stuff we discuss. That's this Thursday night live, 9 p.m. Central, 10 p.m. Eastern. Tim, that's 7 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. in the Mountain Time Range. How about that?
Right on.
All right. I told you the fast food wars, which is what I think we should call this because they're happening more often. Strange stories that are taking place at fast food restaurants.
Yeah.
Are you ready for this? Let's go to Memphis for this first story, Tim.
Okay.
Holy cow. Police in Memphis say they've arrested two customers for starting a shooting in a Burger King restaurant. All right. Why would they start, Tim? What would be the possible reason that you would feel, I need to pull out my gun and start shooting. If you were at a Burger King restaurant, what in God's green earth could piss you off enough to make you want to start shooting up a Burger King?
I only have one, Dave, and if it's just a personal thing with me, and it's just recently, Burger King has released the Chiking sandwich. I don't know what the blank a Chiking is, but the name alone makes me want to shoot people.
Wow. It does have to do with the chicken sandwich, Tim. So you're kind of on the right path. Police in Memphis say they've arrested two customers for starting a shooting in a Burger King restaurant after being served a chicken sandwich with too much hot sauce, Fox 13 reported. Two people were hit by gunfire, the outlet reported, citing police records. An affidavit shows police received a call to Burger King in the Hollywood area of Memphis on June 6th. A female passenger later identified as 20-year-old Kiona Halliburton in a car had an altercation with staff over a spicy chicken sandwich, per the affidavit, the publication reported. After the altercation, Halliburton left the store in a car with driver Tavares McKinney, age 22. That's what Fox 13 is reporting. They then returned in a car and fired multiple shots from the road into the parking lot at four people, the publication reported, citing the affidavit. Two were hit by the gunfire. Halliburton and McKinney were charged with four counts of attempted first-degree murder, four counts of employment of a firearm during the commission of a felony, Fox 13 said, and one count of how can there ever be too much sauce on anything? That's what I want to know, Tim.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The outlet spoke to an uncle of one of the people Halliburton and McKinney shot at, who said that his niece had told him that Halliburton complained that her chicken sandwich had too much hot sauce on it. It is the latest in a series of violent incidents taking place at food and drink chains. On Sunday, a Florida man was accused of pulling a gun on a Starbucks employee who turned out to be the local police chief's daughter because there wasn't enough cream cheese on his bagel. But in a way, Tim, that only the fast food wars could go.
Mm-hmm.
McDonald's is not going to have Burger King overshine them in the good or bad news department.
Okay.
And Iowa is like, here, hold my beer. Two people shooting up over angry hot sauce? I think not. A 42-year-old Iowa man was arrested Saturday, Tim, after he allegedly threatened to blow up a McDonald's chicken restaurant because they didn't give him enough dipping sauce to go with his chicken nuggets, according to police. So it's chicken, Tim. It's all of the antibiotics and steroids they're pumping into our chicken. It's causing rage.
I heard a story recently that McDonald's can no longer, and I might be off here, but they no longer can refer to them as chicken McNuggets, that they can only refer to them as McNuggets because there isn't enough chicken per part.
What?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, let's look into that before we go any further.
I have to Google this, but I was listening to a radio program, and they had mentioned it in passing that they had seen an article that said that McDonald's can no longer refer to, and I'm going to Google this real quick, that McDonald's can no longer refer to chicken McNuggets as chicken.
That's weird.
Yeah. And so I
what
thought,
next? Not the McRib because there's not enough rib? I don't know. Well, this isn't rib meat. This is thigh and inner buttocks meat. So you'll have to call it the inner buttocks meat sandwich. I'd still eat it, Tim, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it just seems weird.
Robert Goldwitzer Jr. allegedly called and threatened a McDonald's located in Ankeny, Iowa, on Saturday at 5:20 p.m. after realizing that his order was incorrect, Who 13 reported. Who are you going to turn to? That's right, Channel 13 News. Who? WHO. Ankeny Police Sergeant Corey Schnenden told the news outlet that during the phone call, Goldwitzer allegedly made violent threats to blow up the restaurant and punch an employee. Police said a complaint was filed by the restaurant, after which officers successfully contacted Goldwitzer using the phone number the threat was called from. During police interviews, Gollwitzer admitted to making the violent statements. Gollwitzer was arrested Saturday, charged with a Class D felony, false report of explosive or incendiary device. He was booked into the Polk County Jail later that day and released on bond. Saturday's incident in Ankeny was not the first time a McDonald's employee was allegedly threatened this month. On June 14th, Sharice Cleveland was arrested in Ravenna, Ohio, and charged with assaulting two staff members during an altercation. Cleveland became upset when staff told her they could not mix three slushy flavors together, which is complete BS. You can do it. I've seen it done. And she allegedly responded by going behind the counter to try to make her own drink. A video that has gone viral shows Cleveland allegedly attacking two staff members before a police officer responded to the scene and placed her in handcuffs. You realize what people are going to jail for? Not enough dipping sauce, too mm-hmm. much dipping sauce, mm-hmm. and that you can't mix the red, blue, and white frosty ice drinks together. Is it really worth going to jail over this, folks?
I think so.
A judge ordered her not to return to McDonald's location and not have any contact with the alleged victims. Well, you know what they've done now is because I used to like to go in and when they had those ices, I liked the cherry icy, half vanilla shake and then half cherry icy on top. And you mix it. You can thank me later, folks. Now they can't do that because the cups, everything's computerized. So you hit the button and it fills it to the exact limit. There's no half cupping. So that's kind of a crazy little deal right there. 1 week earlier, a man was arrested in Virginia after threatening several McDonald's employees and brandishing a BB gun over a conflict regarding the menu. Like the fact that none of the burgers ever look anywhere remotely as big, plump, and juicy as they do when you get them, Tim? Could that be part of it?
Maybe, yeah.
McDonald's has previously drawn criticism for failing to protect employees from harassment or violent threats from customers. In 2019, a group of 17 workers from the Chicago area sued the fast food chain for what they alleged was a nationwide pattern of such abuse. In response to that lawsuit, McDonald's says that it takes seriously its responsibility to provide and foster a safe working environment for our employees and along with our franchisees, continue to make investments in training programs that uphold safe environments for customers and crew members. In addition to training, McDonald's maintains stringent policies against violence in our restaurants. Well, why do you even have to say that? I think everybody does that. Do you need to put that assurance out? Is KFC like, well, we have a lenient policy when it comes to violence? I didn't think so.
Yeah.
Speaking of your whole concept of we can no longer call it chicken McNuggets. Remember the old urban legend that they changed it to KFC because it wasn't really chicken that they were serving. So they could no longer call it chicken. So that's why they just went to KFC. And that proved to be
right. That,
yeah.
Like I said, I just heard this on a radio program. It didn't sound right to me that was true, and I'm sitting here going through Google, and I'm not seeing any news article that says this.
Well, in my case, maybe Worm McNugget would have been the better title because it appeared there was much more worm than there was chicken in mine.
I think it's just a story that it's just an urban legend that people are passing around, but I don't know. You would think that there would be a news story out there that.
It's if it was a morning show, they just ramble. They talk incessantly about insane things that aren't even true. Just to have some content, Tim. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Let's do another food related crime, Tim. I love this one. They're very at the old Law and Crime website that I'm at. They're very clever. Okay. Pissed off. PIST. Pissed off. California truck driver allegedly stole more than 42,000 pounds of pistachios for illicit resale scheme. Pistachios are expensive, man.
They are, very.
It is the gold standard of the nut world. A delivery truck driver in California is being accused of stealing a trailer containing tens of thousands of pounds of pistachios and running what appeared to be an illegal black market for the product out of a trucking yard. According to reports, the Touchstone Pistachio Company earlier this month ran a routine audit on its inventory and discovered that more than 42,000 pounds of its main product had gone missing. The company reported the possible theft to the Tulare County Sheriff's Office, which opened the investigation into the missing nuts. The BBC reported that agricultural detectives in Tulare County worked with investigators from two other counties to track down the culprit behind this shell game, Tim.
Oh, God.
The TCSO on Saturday announced that investigators had located the missing pistachios and arrested 34-year-old Alberto Montemayor of Montemayor Trucking. Yesterday, investigating leads in Fresno and Kern County discovered the tractor trailer containing the pistachios had been moved from the Montemayor Trucking lot in Delano to a nearby lot. Detectives found that the pistachios were being moved from 2,000-pound sacks into smaller bags for resale. So they're cutting the nuts, Tim. You don't know what they're cutting your nuts with. That's the important thing.
You never do know. But no. Pistachios are like $8 or $9 a pound, aren't they?
I know. They're crazy.
So if so you said it was 42,000 pounds?
Yeah.
Okay, so I got my calculator out here. So 42,000 pounds. Let's just say they're $8 a pound, okay? So that is $336,000 worth of pistachios.
It's a lot of nuts.
That's
people tell us this show is a lot of nuts, and with this story we can agree.
Yeah,
crazy. The pistachio nut is a major facet of California's economy, with the nut accounting for approximately $5.2 billion in economic activity, resulting in more than 47,000 jobs, according to the American Pistachio Growers, a nonprofit trade association representing pistachio farmers in California, New Mexico, and Arizona. The Touchstone incident is not the first time an alleged thief in California has targeted the lucrative commodity in a planned heist. Last year, the Tulare County Sheriff's Office charged 23-year-old Banva Singh Sakhan with grand theft and conspiracy theft for stealing nearly $300,000 worth of pistachios. According to a TCSO press release, Sakhan's scheme relied on him posing as a legitimate delivery service to secure contracts to deliver bulk shipments of nuts, which he then picked up and kept for resale. The Capital Press last year reported that the market for purloined nuts reached an all-time high. This is it, Tim. Between 2014 and 2017, organized crime rings stole nearly $8 million worth of nuts. Cocaine, heroin, smuggling people in and out of the country. Mm-hmm. That's what you think of when you think organized crime rings, not the big nut industry.
No, there may be more money in nuts, in your nuts, than there are in cocaine.
I can tell you, I've had to spend a lot of money because of my nuts, Tim, throughout my life.
You know,
an inordinate amount of money.
You know, you may need to start getting into the nut ring to pay for shipping out your package.
That was, by the way, let me just tell you, that was the worst of the Rings movies.
Ring two.
Rings and the nut ring.
Yeah, that the nut ring. You could skip that one. It was pretty boring. Yeah.
Not a good one to choose from. Yeah. Good God, a nut conspiracy ring. I would love to see like a new Sopranos based around the nut wars.
The nut wars.
Florida man hurled a glass of salsa at a 7-Eleven shopper for no reason at all, Tim. Just, you know, sometimes you're in a 7-Eleven and you're like, somebody's got to go down and it's going to be Tostitos brand salsa that brings him down. A Florida man has been arrested for allegedly hurling a glass jar of salsa at a man without any provocation. Latrell Trosalis, which is a crazy sounding dinosaur to me, Tim, age 31, was arrested Wednesday night for battery, enhanced to a felony due to a prior conviction for battery, for allegedly hurting fellow 7-Eleven customer John Senning upon throwing the jar of Tostitos salsa at him, according to the Pinellas County arrest affidavit obtained by the Smoking Gun on Friday. The suspect threw Tostitos salsa at another man, cops said. Trisalis, who stands about 6'2", weighing 300 pounds, entered the St. Petersburg store, took the 15.5-ounce glass jar from a shelf, and threw it unprovoked at Senning.
Wow.
The force of the throw caused the glass jar to break on the victim's back. Wow, those are thick jars. How hard did you whip that thing to make it shatter on somebody's back? More importantly, how strong is this guy's back that it could shatter a glass jar?
I don't know, but where is Rocco Baldelli, the manager of the Minnesota Twins, in all this?
Because I don't know.
We need a pitcher and we need a guy who can hit. And obviously, those two guys need to be signed.
Holy cow. Senning sustained visible swelling redness and a minor laceration, but he did get to take his base, Tim.
Oh, good.
In the incident, which another party witnessed and which was captured on surveillance video, according to the document. How much do you think it cost the Trisalis Rex to pitch a bottle of salsa to try to get recognized by the MLB, Tim? How much? What's that little fine going to cost him?
Dave, I'm going to go $5,000 if it got upgraded to a felony.
Online records show that Tosaurus Rex is still in jail in lieu of a $4,500 bond, of which $2,000. Okay, I want you to put this into your head.
Okay,
$4,500 for whipping a jar of salsa at somebody's back hard enough that it shattered the jar. Jeez. That makes it sound like, okay, that's a pretty good price.
Yeah.
But what if you found out that $2,000 of that was because he nabbed a 7-Eleven ice cream bar and ate it, according to the outlet. So suddenly you've been downgraded. Your attack really only cost him $2,500, but stealing an ice cream bar cost him $2,000. Does that seem unbalanced to you?
Yeah, no, it was a combo platter, Dave. I mean, you know, if he would have just took the money out of his pocket and paid for it, he could have saved himself some trouble. But, yeah.
All right. This is a fair warning to you kids and parents listening to this show. This story you may not want the children to hear. The next two stories you may not want the children to hear. So if you want to give them earmuffs, plug their ears and start humming the Star Spangled Banner whilst we read these next two stories, Tim.
That'd be entertaining. I'd like to see that, actually. Yeah.
Are you curious about where the average street dealer safely stores their stash, Tim?
Oh, yes, I am. Yeah, very much.
Well, wonder no more, my friend. A Florida man, again, oh, so hard to believe this would fall on Florida.
No.
A Florida man whose rap sheet includes more than a dozen drug convictions was arrested last month after jailers discovered 4 crystal rocks of methamphetamine stored inside the defendant's penis skin. Shaft Bang Adams is his name.
What?
Where else is he going to hide it with a name like Shaft Bang Adams? He was collared, and I'm not kidding, that's his name. Shaft Bang Adams, 30, was collared in mid-May for driving with a suspended or revoked license and booked into the Orange County Jail on the misdemeanor count. Adams, an Orlando resident, was familiar with lockup owing to his 20-plus prior convictions for offenses like domestic assault, battery, possession of a controlled substance, delivery of cocaine, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, false imprisonment, and possession of drug paraphernalia. The bigger question isn't why is he putting crystal meth in his wiener hole, but more importantly, Tim, why is he out when he has 20-plus prior convictions for offenses like assault, battery, possession, delivery of cocaine, possession of firearms, convicted felon, false imprisonment, and possession of drug paraphernalia? Why is this guy out on the road at all?
Because that meth's got to get delivered, Dave. That's why.
I guess it's not going to deliver itself. That's during the jail intake process, Adams was subjected to a strip search during which a correctional officer reported finding 4 crystal rocks, white in color, inside the penis folds of Mr. Adams. Okay, you got to give law enforcement, give them the applause they deserve right now to think of that, Tim. Give it to them. Because you might think, okay, we're going to check up the pooper because that's an obvious prison purse. But it's true. But to stick it in the elephant trunk, the uncircumcised wiener skin, Tim, that's, first of all, I would think that would be absorbed.
Not if crystal. He had a plastic bag.
No, it's not plastic bags. He just had 4 rocks stored in the penis skin in the folds.
If you got in a little cellophane, if you wrap it in a little cellophane. God. Yeah.
He didn't, though, as I'm stating to you. Now, listen to this. So he was driving on a suspended license. So we can add that to domestic assault, battery, possession of a controlled substance, delivery of cocaine, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, false imprisonment, and possession of drug paraphernalia. He's driving on a suspended license. They come in and his Pez dispenser penis has four rocks of crystal meth in it. He spent 8 days in custody. And how much was his bond?
Ooh, gosh, if he's got the old flip top working. I'm going to go $5,000 again here, Dave. I'm going to go with the $5,000 answer.
$2,000.
That's it?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but don't worry, because he's back behind bars again. He was arrested yesterday on cocaine possession and resisting charges. So he should be out next week on a $1,500 bond. How the fuck is this guy getting out? How I asked him. How?
Well, he's probably just doing more jobs, Dave. He's probably got a lot of money.
Here's our second story where you might want to block the kids' ears. Mm-hmm. Oh, but first of all, kids, don't do drugs. You don't know where they've been hidden or tucked. And please, 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 folks. Oh, God. I watch teenage girls standing in line at Starbucks, and they've got their money in their hand, and they're touching it to their face and to their lips. And I've watched 2 feet in front of them, some morbidly obese person reach deep into the folds of their boob encasement to pull out dollar bills. And you don't know where the change is coming. Don't put money by your mouth or rub it on your face, please. This is just a PSA from your friends at Darkness Radio on Instagram Tuesday.
And one other PSA, scrape the foreskin cheese off your meth before you smoke it.
Oh, there really? You go. Why did you have to go there?
Well, I just,
I don't know.
You gotta, but go ahead.
Here's something that sounds Floridian in nature, mm-hmm. but it turns out it's from Brooklyn. Brownsville, Brooklyn, police launched an investigation Wednesday after a man sexually assaulted a woman in a Brooklyn beauty supply store. The NYPD said, according to police, the woman was in the Sutter Avenue store in the Brownsville section just before 2 p.m. when an unidentified man approached her from behind. As the victim bent over to remove an item from a refrigerator, the man proceeded to bend over and lick her buttocks, authorities said.
Wow.
When he confronted the man, he exited the store and fled in an unknown direction. Oh, there's video, Tim.
Really?
It's video. Yeah. Mm. The NYPD released the above surveillance video of the strange encounter with the hope that the public could help identify this ass licker. Police described him as between 25 and 35, standing between 5 feet, 8 inches tall and weighing about 160. He was last seen wearing a Philadelphia Eagles 91 jersey, a dark blue baseball cap, which is really kind of that navy blue New York Yankees. I don't know why they're not getting a little bit more specific in this, because I can see the picture, and dark colored sneakers. So, folks, if you know who this ass licker is, you can call Crime Stoppers at 1-800-577-TIPS. I said tips, Tim. T-I-P-S. Oh,
yeah, right. So wait a minute.
1-800-577-8477 if you know who this Brooklyn ass licker is.
So body's representing Philly. Cap is representing the Yankees.
Yeah.
So he's
and
confused.
Shoes are representing Nike.
Okay, so he's confused.
Is he?
Yeah. You can't.
It's hard to be a Giants fan.
Well,
I got to give him credit.
No. I mean, the Giants are on the way up. I mean, you can represent the Giants. That's fine. I mean, you can't. I mean, nobody in the NFC East is actually that good. Let's face it.
Well, any of you in the NFC East, you can just go right over to Tim's house at 314.
Hey,
I just figured if they should be able to go talk to you about this in person.
They can email me. Email me. Tim@darknessradio.com. We'll talk.
Tim, this sounds dirtier than it is, but have you ever been jugged?
Well, I've had my experimental period. Yeah.
Right. It sounds, I gotta be honest. You're like, hey, be careful. You don't want to get jugged when you leave a bank. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I do. Right.
Well,
getting money at the bank. Beware of criminal bank jugging. This is another PSA from your friends at, True Crime Tuesday, Darkness Radio, Tim, because I'd never heard this before. If I didn't, I got to guess most of our audience is not as tuned into the drug and jugging culture as you are, Tim. They may appreciate getting the heads up on this.
It's not a drug thing, Dave.
No, I know, but you know all about drugs and jugging.
It's just a heads up. It's a, you got to be careful when you're, doing the money or transaction thing with your cards. Yeah.
While the origin of the word jugging isn't clear, Urban Dictionary definitions include playing someone and stealing. But here's how local law enforcement say it works. Bad guys sit in their cars surveilling the comings and goings at local banks. When they follow people they believe got money to their next stop, when the person leaves the car, often on another errand, the criminals break in, find the money in the console, trunk, or under the seat, and make off with the cash. Bank customers who walk out with bank bags, envelopes, or coin boxes are often targets, according to Tampa police. A spokesperson for the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office said they have not seen cases of bank jugging. They have not. Well, then why are we talking about it? But according to Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office, there were 27 juggings reported countywide from January through April this year, with about $110,000 stolen from victims. In one case, the loss may have been more valuable than cash. On May 30th, 2020, a recent widower went to the Bank of America and in Tampa to get his late wife's jewelry from the safety deposit box for his daughter's upcoming wedding. Aww. He put the jewelry in his trunk, then made two more stops, parking his car and leaving it for a short time. According to Tampa police, he returned to find a door lock had been punched out, his trunk opened, and all of his wife's jewelry gone. According to a police spokesperson this week, there have been no arrests or recoveries. In September of 2019, a man withdrew $10,000 from Wells Fargo, drove to a second Wells Fargo to make another withdrawal, parked in the bank's back lot, and returned to find his truck broken into and his money gone from the center console. Who would leave 20 grand in a car anyway?
Yeah, you can't. You got to carry it on you at all times.
Holy shnikes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here's tips from law enforcement. If you think you're being targeted, call 911 on your cell phone. Tell the dispatcher where you are. Number two, never leave or hide money in your car, even if you think it's safe because you're parked at home. These are crimes of opportunity that are easily prevented. That's what the police had to say about this. Beware of your surroundings and returning to your car with your money. Keep it hidden in your purse or in your pocket. That's what they asked him. It's a simple request.
Yeah.
Quick weird story that crosses over to Darkness Radio territory here. But Tim, there was a strange incident that took place at a Home Depot in Pennsylvania's Lackawanna County. That's right. Details are still scarce on this of exactly what was going on, but in the Home Depot on Commerce Drive in Dixon City Monday afternoon, police were called at around 3:26 p.m. to escort several people out of the store for what was being called bad behavior. According to the reports, these people were conducting an exorcism on lumber.
Naughty pines.
Yeah.
Yeah,
very naughty. Very. The police blotter item posted on the Dixon City Police Facebook page gave a few clues 5 times fast. It doesn't want to come out easily even once. 3:26 p.m. Commerce Boulevard at Home Depot for disorderly people having an exorcism in the lumber aisle for the dead trees. They were escorted out of the building. Maybe they were trying to exercise high prices because lumber is through the roof right now.
It is. It's slowly starting to come down a little bit, but that's kind of one of the reasons why housing prices are getting to be so high, too.
That's nuts.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Florida man also back in the headlines with this story from Fort Myers. A thief pressed his luck looting a load of lottery tickets from a Gulf Coast convenience store, then returning to the scene to try to swipe a safe. The double dipping all caught on camera inside the Fort Myers, Florida store with police were releasing the video showing the man walking in, wrestling with the lottery ticket machine, then taking off with as many tickets as he could manage. He must have been feeling lucky because he returned in a different set of clothing with 2 targets for his second go around, the cash register and the safe. His luck ran out, though. Turns out it was empty. Police are hoping the public can put him in a different set of clothing, one belonging to a jail inmate. Wah, wah. So he got away twice in the same store. What the deuce, dude? Florida, you ballsy sons of bitches. All right, our final story is here. I can attest and understand the story, and I almost think it's not a crime, Tim.
Okay.
When you got to go, you got to go 110 miles per hour. That was a defense of a driver in Maine who was pulled over by police for driving 65 miles per hour over the posted 45 mile per hour speed limit. CentralMaine.com reports that when police officers asked motorist Robert Corson why he was driving so fast. The driver, who was reportedly charged with criminal speeding, operating after suspension, and driving under the influence, said his female passenger needed to use a bathroom. He was being chivalrous, Tim.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Maine motorist drove 110 miles per hour in a 45 mile per hour zone, supposedly because his passenger needed the bathroom. The passenger did apparently go to the bathroom in a Circle K while the white Toyota's driver was being arrested in the convenience store's parking lot Tuesday. Pursuit occurred roughly halfway between Bangor and Augusta in the town of Fairfield. Neither the driver nor passenger who put the P in speed was cooperative, police said. That's what was written in this article, Tim. They put the in speed.
No.
Yeah.
Can you just see the guy as he's in handcuffs and being led into the squad car, yelling into the Circle K, "The things I do for you!"
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this week, kids. Remember, Thursday, very cool live presentation of Darkness Radio Presents. It's a true crime and paranormal twist. The Devil Made Me Do It. We're going to talk about the new Conjuring case and story with Jeff Belanger. We'll talk deeply about the criminal case of it, the paranormal case of it, and we're doing that live Thursday night. Go check out Darkness Radio's YouTube page. Subscribe to it. It's free. And then hit the bell so you never miss it. And give us a thumbs up. That's all I'm asking. All right, that's it. We will be back again next week with more of the best in true crime talk radio. For that guy, I'm this guy. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday.